LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and my guest today is Keith Preston, who joins us to discuss his book, Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. More than half of the world's countries are democracies, even if in name only. Democracy is hailed by its advocates as the only rational political system, producing the best outcomes for the greatest number of citizens. But is this belief grounded more in ideology than reality? Are modern democratic governments actually doing more harm than good when it comes to the daily lives of individuals? Although the very idea may be regarded as unthinkable, democracy is essentially a gentrified form of mob rule, and its failings are becoming increasingly obvious both in the West and in imitator countries around the world. And yet, no matter how bad things get, few can even imagine an alternative. However, in anarchism, a much maligned set of social, cultural, political, and economic models, genuine alternatives exist, and Preston makes a convincing case on their behalf. His recent study in anarchist theory and practice is committed to the promotion of decentralized societies, autonomous regions and localities, self-managed municipalities and villages, stateless tribes and voluntary associations, people's militias and federated communities. The foundations for a new, diversified world, even as the old world is falling apart. Hello and welcome, Keith, and thank you so much for joining us today on LegalizeFreedom.com.
Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me on your program.
Okay, so this is our first time talking today, Keith. So we're discussing a collection of writings that you've recently put out. It's entitled Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. Before we jump into that, for listeners who don't know, just give them a bit of information about your background and your work in general.
Okay. Well, I have been involved in dissident politics or alternative politics in the United States for over 35 years, probably pushing 40 years by now. And I've been in and around a lot of different kind of alternative political tendencies. When I first started out in the late 80s with all of this, I was in the left-wing anarchist scene, and I was also a part of the general left subculture, which was a little different than it is now, but not dramatically different. In the 90s, I became interested in libertarianism, and I belonged to the Libertarian Party for a while. And I also started discovering right-wing populism. And in the United States, we have a subculture of people that are into survivalism and guns and that kind of stuff. So I was around that, at least on the periphery for a while. And then in the 2000s, when the war on terrorism and the war in Iraq and all of that stuff began, I was interested in the anti-war left, but I also started checking out the anti-war right, and that led me to discover, I already knew about the libertarians and the paleoconservatives in the United States, but I also started to discover the European right and things like the European New Right and European-style conservatism. And along the way, I started developing my own approach to politics. And, you know, I've identified as an anarchist for my entire adult life. And I found that very haphazardly. It started when I was in high school and I had an English literature class. And it was about there was a unit we were doing that was about the Romance poets. And while I was a terrible student, I do remember reading in my textbook about Percy Bysshe Shelley and how he was the son-in-law of the anarchist William Godwin. And I started thinking, wow, there is a such thing? That's interesting. Because, I mean, to me, anarchist just meant like the Sex Pistols and stuff like that. So I decided I would actually look up William Godwin in the encyclopedia. And this was years before there was an internet or Google searches or anything like that. So I looked up William Godwin in the generic encyclopedia, and I started seeing that there was this whole philosophy called anarchism, and it had been a movement and had its own leading thinkers and all of these other things. And so that got me interested in anarchism as a political ideology and system of political thought. And then I started becoming interested in the social sciences on a more general level. I'm also an academic. I have undergrad degrees in psychology, religion, and history, and I have graduate degrees in the social sciences or sociology and in history as well. So along the way, I've sort of combined my academic work and professional work because I've also worked as a university lecturer. And I've combined that with my more private interest in anarchist political theory and in the social sciences on a more comprehensive level. And what that book, Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire, is, for years I've run a website. I've been the main editor of a website called attackthesystem.com that first went online about 25 years ago. And I've been the main editor ever since. And I've used that website to just publish my own writings and commentary, as well as news and commentary by other people. And then we've had lots of other contributors along the way. And a few years ago, a guy who has been a longtime reader, longtime associate, sometimes contributor to Attack the System, named Eric Noonan, he put together a very lengthy anthology of my work in a PDF form. It's a you know he put together an ATS Attack the System anthology. It's probably about 700 pages if you print it out, as a Word doc. And that includes a lot of my writings from a span of about 25 years, plus a few things by other people that we've had as well. And then Troy Southgate, who, as you may know, operates the Blackfront publishing service, he decided he wanted to publish some more anarchist literature, and he agreed very graciously to publish some of my work as part of a book series. And this is the first book in the series. It's called Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire. And that title is based on an essay that I wrote way back in 2003, around the time that the war in Iraq was beginning, the second war in Iraq was beginning. And the second part of the book is an older draft of the statement of purpose of Attack the System. Attack the System has gone through multiple statements of purpose over time, and the one we have today is not the same one that's in the book. It's similar, but it's the one in the book is a little older. And what you can see when you compare the two is the evolution of Attack the System over time. But the statement of purpose reflects the way that I and people who are generally sympathetic to my work approach anarchist theory and its application. What I have done as a political philosopher is take anarchist political theory as it began to develop in the 18th and 19th and 20th century and synthesize all of the different currents that you have within anarchist thought and with other overlapping or adjacent philosophies, the wider body of libertarian, decentralist, anti-statist, anti-authoritarian thought. I've sort of synthesized those in various ways. And then I've also brought in bits and pieces of other philosophies that may be relevant or may help fill in the gaps in the wider theoretical system. I mean, if you read things that I've written, if you just go to any book I've written or any essay I've written or any blog post I've written or any lecture I've given, depending on what you're listening to or reading, you might think I'm either far right or far left or libertarian or left-wing anarchist or liberal or conservative or moderate or Marxist or something else. But all there is a system to all of that, it's basically a theoretical system that I've developed, synthesizing these various anarchist and anti-state and anti-authoritarian traditions, and then, like I said, fleshing it out with bits and pieces of other things as I felt were appropriate. And the book Philosophical Anarchism and the Death of Empire is a pretty good reflection of my overall approach to political philosophy and political theory.
Well, some of the temporal markers that you mentioned, in particular the War on Terror, we'll get to, because I suspect we've lived through a lot, if not all, of the same kind of global events and trends. Can I just check you mentioned late 80s. Can I check your age? I'm 55.
I am 58. I will be 59 in October.
There we go. Yes, yeah, so same generation. So it might be useful at this stage to basically say what anarchism isn't, basically, because in the late 80s, I'm a heavy metal guy from music point of view, but I was interested in hardcore and in punk, and aggressive music. And any thoughts I had about what, anarchism was came from that. It came from leftist tendencies, in the punk scene, as you mentioned, the Sex Pistols. But I'm getting into the 80s, bands like Conflict and Crass and things like that. And for a lot of people, anarchism is just derived from just the word anarchy, and a lot of people think of that in its colloquial use. It's like, oh man, there was no teacher in the classroom; it was anarchy. So just completely uncontrolled mayhem, which is not at all. So maybe you could just, for people who are thinking, how can you possibly have a society running under anarchism? Just say some kind of concise word about what anarchism isn't.
Yeah, well, the popular meaning of anarchy is anarchy in the pejorative sense, where it's chaos and violence and general craziness and disorder going on. And there are certainly people who self-identify as anarchists who have done their part to give anarchism that image. So, there's some self-responsibility, I think, that the people who identify as anarchists need to take for that. As for the punk subculture from the 70s, some of those people really were anarchist in an ideological sense. For example, you mentioned the band Crass. They really are ideological anarchists. The Sex Pistols weren't. I mean, the Sex Pistols were just a marketing gimmick created by a guy who wanted to sell weird clothes. There's that kind of anarchy. And then there is an ideological, philosophical approach to anarchism. But no, anarchism as a philosophy is not just the idea that there should just be total disorder or total chaos, or that crime should have free reign, and all of these kinds of things. That's not what anarchism is. Anarchism is a theoretical system, an analytical model in some ways, that developed in the 18th and 19th century. I mean, it certainly has prototypes going back to older times. I mean, you can go back to ancient Chinese philosophy and ancient Greek philosophy and ancient Persian philosophy and see prototypes for what becomes anarchism at a later time. Like some people say Lao Tzu, the founder supposedly of the Taoist religion. Some people say he was the first anarchist. Some people say Diogenes, the Cynic philosopher, was the first anarchist. But so there's in many older societies, traditional cultures, and many different religious and philosophical and ethical traditions, there is proto-anarchist thought. There's a British historian of anarchism named Peter Marshall, who's written very extensively about this, and there are others as well. But modern anarchism, that is, people calling themselves anarchists, developed. I guess the first person to call himself an anarchist was Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, who was a French economist that lived in the early 19th century. Godwin was sort of a proto-anarchist. He was a British philosopher that belonged to the radical wing of the Enlightenment and classical liberalism and all of that. Then you had Max Stirner, who had this philosophy he called egoism. And that he was sort of a proto-anarchist also. But then I think Proudhon was the first person to adopt the label, at least the first person that's well known for having done so. And Proudhon was sort of a radical economist who opposed the rise of early capitalism in the 19th century. And then you have anarchism crystallizing into an actual movement by the mid to late 19th century. You see a fellow named Bakunin, who was an early rival of Karl Marx. Then you see a follower of Bakunin, a guy named Kropotkin. They were both Russians. He became another leading intellectual, and anarchist movements became part of the radical labor movement in the 19th century as a reaction to the rise of modernity and capitalism what we think of as modern society, and then the social dislocations and socioeconomic polarizations that were associated with that. And in the late 19th century, there was a wave of terrorism committed by people who self-identified as anarchists. It's not that all anarchists were in favor of this or approved of it or participated in it, but some of the image that anarchists have as terrorists is not entirely unjustified, because there was a wave of anarchist terrorism in the late 19th century, early 20th century. There was actually a very interesting article written probably about 15 or 20 years ago by Johann Hari, the British writer that some listeners may be familiar with. And Hari wrote an article, I believe it was called The Original Terrorists. And of course, this was when Islamic terrorism was one of the big things on everyone's mind. And he was talking about the anarchist terrorists of the late 19th and early 20th century and how similar they were to some of the Islamist terrorists of today. Now, most modern anarchists will eschew this. They will reject. They will say, well, look, just because they did that doesn't mean that's necessarily what they're for. But the other side of that is the image of anarchists as terrorists is not entirely unfounded, because there really were anarchist terrorists back during that time period. It was called propaganda by the deed, where anarchists would at times engage in actual terrorism as a means of trying to inspire the masses to revolt against oppressive or authoritarian conditions or institutions. Now, in the 20th century, you start to see a shift of focus among anarchists, where you start to see the rise of what's called anarcho-syndicalism. And the idea there is that workers gain control of industry and production through general strikes and labor self-organizing. So anarchists and anarcho-syndicalists became sort of the radical wing of the 20th century as well. A lot of people don't remember this, but there was actually in Spain in the 1930s, during the Spanish Civil War, a brief period where anarchists were actually in control of some of the provinces of Spain, like Catalonia and Aragon and some of those. And anarchists actually were managed to create worker-run industries and some of that before it was overrun by the other parties in that particular war, like the communists, the Francistas, the armies of Francisco Franco and all of that. And then there was another wave of anarchist development in the 1960s, when the new left and the 60s counterculture and the 60s protest movement emerged in response to things like the Vietnam War and all of the other things that were going on in the 60s. You start to see a new wave of anarchist thinkers that came along and became very influential. Noam Chomsky is by far the most well-known, although many people say he's really only an anarchist fellow traveler, because he's basically just a functional liberal. But he in his career as a public intellectual, Chomsky has certainly been very influential on anarchist thought. There was another fellow named Murray Bookchin, and he also was a major late 20th century anarchist theorist. And the actual some of the Kurdish insurgent groups in Syria, like the people in Rojava, which is a sort of a group that's an offshoot from the PKK, they were heavily influenced by Murray Bookchin and his work. You also see other anarchists who become very influential in other ways. And you also see a lot of branches of anarchism emerge that have different focuses and emphasis. Like anybody who reads a basic article or book or Wikipedia entry or whatever about anarchism will know that you have all these hyphenated forms of anarchism. You've got anarcho-communism, anarcho-syndicalism, anarcho-primitivism, anarcho-capitalism, anarcho-transhumanism. You've got all these different types of anarchism that have some particular focus or emphasis. I once heard a political scientist joke that there are about as many types of anarchism or political philosophies put together, and that's probably not too far from the truth. Anarchists are kind of like Protestants. They've got all these many different denominations with all these different practices and beliefs that, some of which may seem strange to outsiders. And that's kind of where anarchism as a philosophy and movement is today. You have all these little niche subcultures. Sometimes some of them are mostly just exist online. Others exist as sort of youth counterculture tendencies. Others you find in activist circles, but they're still out there. On the left, you've seen a lot of blending of anarchists with things like the Black Bloc and some of these Antifa groups and stuff like that. But there are also anarchists on the right. You have people who self-identify as anarcho-nationalists, and there's a tendency called national anarchism, which I would say is very similar to panarchism, which was an idea that developed in the 19th century. It was developed by Paul-Émile Depew, who was a British, I mean, he was a Belgian political theorist who was something of a fellow traveler to anarchism. Also, folkish anarchism, like Gustav Landa, an early 20th century German anarchist who was played a part in the German Revolution of 1919. He was later murdered by the Freikorps. There's a lot of different types of anarchist subcultures and niche cultures today. Even if the influence of anarchism on the wider society remains limited.
Okay, so going back to my early life, and you'll have a story to tell on this front as well, which I'd like to tease out. This is something, the ideas we're talking about of how society is organized, and basically it's been, I've been questioning for as long as I can remember. And I recall at 3 years old, being taken by my mother to a preschool nursery type thing. So this was like a year before I was due to start primary or elementary school. And little kids like me went there to do the base, start to do the basics if we hadn't already done them at home, numbers and the alphabet and all of that, etc. And I remember being really, I'm an only child, no brothers or sisters. And I remember being very, very distressed by this. I couldn't understand why my mother was taking me to this place full of strangers and leaving me there. And stemming from that was a lifelong question, which has been with me ever since. And when I moved through school life and then into secondary school or high school, as you would say in the States, all the time I was asking myself, where did I sign up for this? People saying you have to do this and you have to do that. I say, well, I was just born, pink and screaming into this world. And I was kind of trying to make my own way. But left, right, and center are all these people saying you have to do this and you have to do that because that's the way it is. I thought, I didn't agree to this. I didn't agree to have these politicians ruling over me. I didn't agree to go to this school. Why do I have to? And then, of course, I found out actually in the law, you didn't have to. So where did I sign up for this? That's kind of my lifelong question. And I thought, well, why can't I just do my own thing? Maybe with other people who want to do their own thing as well. And this is where the idea of voluntarism comes in, that I freely associate, for example, with you because we both want to, but not with someone else or their way of doing things because I don't want that. So you'll have a story, no doubt, about when this first arose in your consciousness.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you bring this up because I was just at a political conference here in the States this past weekend where I told this story I'm going to tell now. But I my first political intuitions were I guess it probably happened when I was in elementary school because at the time I was a small child and I was attending a very conservative private Christian school in a small town in Virginia in the United States. And This school was run by the Independent Fundamental Baptists, which, if you know who they are, they make the Southern Baptists look like, flaming liberals or something. Very conservative, very fundamentalist church denomination. And they had this small private school they were running, and I was an elementary school student there. And Richard Nixon, the former U.S. president, he was running for president at the time, and I didn't know anything about it. But my school actually put us on a bus and took us to a Nixon rally, and it was at some kind of football field or stadium. It was just a small place, some sort of football field or well, we American football over what we call soccer, but it was a little sports stadium-like place, and we were supposed to go out on the field, and then a plane flew over. And when the plane flew over, we were all supposed to say on cue, "We want Nixon, we want Nixon." And I don't know exactly what all that was about, but I'm sure it was something the local Republican Party put to get footage for a campaign ad for television or some kind of propaganda activity. But I remember we were going into the stadium, and there were some older kids at the gate, and I'm going through the gate, and these older kids start pushing me and shoving me, and they're saying, "Do you want Nixon? Do you want Nixon? Say we want Nixon." And I'm like, "Who's this Nixon guy? I don't know any Nixon. I didn't even know who they were talking about. I didn't even know it was a presidential candidate. I thought they were talking about some kid named Nixon or something. It was like, I don't know any Nixon." So I remember that. And then I remember, the going in and the plane flying over and all the other kids saying, "We want Nixon, we want Nixon." I declined to participate because I just figured whoever this Nixon guy was, he must not be any good. So I decided I don't like this Nixon guy. And a few years later, Nixon was actually put out of the presidency in the United States for the Watergate scandal. And I remember thinking at the time, I must have been right about him. He must be a bad guy. It's not any political judgment, just my own, childhood instinct. And I was always something of a natural contrarian when it came to politics. I remember when in 1976, when Jimmy Carter was running for the presidency against the vice president who became president after Nixon, Gerald Ford. And the area that I grew up in, everybody is a Republican. Being a Democrat is basically the same thing as being a communist in their way of thinking. So I decided I was going to be pro Jimmy Carter. And all the other kids in my school, of course, they were all very pro Gerald Ford, being that he was the Republican. So on the day of the election, I remember in the lunchroom, the cafeteria, none of the other kids would sit with me because I'm the Carter guy, sort of a pariah, at least for the day. I mean, they got over it, but that was interesting. I remember in the late 70s, we were having the stagflation crisis here in the United States with runaway inflation. I remember riding in a car. I wasn't old enough to drive a car yet, but I remember riding in a car with, I guess one of my parents was driving, maybe one of my grandparents, but riding past a marquee advertising the price of gasoline. And the marquee said that gasoline was being sold by for $1.06 per gallon, which was outrageous. I had never seen a marquee for gas being sold for more than a dollar. Which today sounds wonderful, but back then that was considered an outrageous price. And I remember thinking, well, how can they do that? How can they sell gas for over a dollar a gallon? I mean, isn't there like a law against that? Isn't that like theft or robbery or something? And my parents explained to me that it was, no, this is what's called inflation. I'm like, what's this inflation thing? I had a number of experiences like that during childhood. I remember one time going to an amusement park with my family, and there was a guy at the amusement park who was one of the employees, but he had a fake arm. And it was one of those old prosthetics that had a hook on the end. It wasn't the modern kind of prosthetics where they try to make it look more natural. And I remember asking my father, I said, what happened to that guy's arm? And he said, my father said, well, he was probably a Vietnam veteran. This was when the Vietnam War was still going on, or had maybe it had just recently ended somewhere in there. But and I knew what the Vietnam War was. I mean, knew that there was a war going on, and the North and the South were fighting. And you know, plus I'd learned in school that, well, America had a civil war, and the North and South had been fighting. And I figured, well, that's just what countries do. The North and South fight. You know, it's no big deal. But I remember asking my father. I said, well, why was an American in Vietnam? And my dad said, well, he was drafted. And I'm like, okay, well, what is drafted? And my dad says, well, that's when they tell you you've got to go fight a war. And I said, well, what if you don't want to go? And then my father said, well, you don't have a choice. You either get drafted or you go to jail. And I'm like, they can do that? So, you know, I suppose, you know, I had this series of childhood experiences that motivated me to question the legitimacy of institutions of authority in a way that expanded over time. Yeah, I remember being in high school seeing a quote from Thomas Jefferson, one of the founders of the United States. The quote was, "A little rebellion now and then is a good thing." That's something that he said after the Shays Rebellion back in early American history. And I remember thinking, "Yeah, that's a good quote. I like that quote. A little rebellion then is a good thing." So I suppose in some ways maybe I was just naturally born to be an anarchist, instinctively, you know, genetically or whatever. I don't know, but that's how it got started.
Yeah, you used the word contrarian a few minutes ago, and I think that's definitely something I'd apply to myself. And that's not stemming from the word contrary. That's not as just, you know, a shit stirrer or a troublemaker for the sake of it, but it's just asking questions that people have become unaccustomed to asking or feel that they can't ask or don't even think that there are questions. I remember in the immediate aftermath of the 9/11 attack, I was a deputy editor of a magazine, and I was responsible for moderating the forum, the online forum for the magazine. And some conversations got started around, you know, not, it was a music magazine, but nothing to do with music, but to do with the American government's response and other governments as well, but particularly in the US, response to 9/11. And curtailments of freedom, you know, and restrictions on around airports and whatnot, some of which was kind of understandable, some of which was kind of like I think a bit of overreach. But anyway, at that point, so I would have been, you know, like say in you know, 40 years old or whatever, talking to some of these kids online who were in their late teens, and their reaction to what was going on. And I was skeptical and cynical, and they were very much kind of like, this is what has to happen, this is what has to be done. And I started talking about the limits to freedom and the whole concept they couldn't really grasp was that the system that we labor under, for example, you in the US, myself in the UK, and you know, most of Western Europe and other similar places, you know, Canada, Australia, etc. That the idea that most people have is that even though there's lots of things that are not ideal and maybe dysfunctional about our political and social system, that it's fundamentally the best model. You know what I mean? It's this liberal democracy, and that if things are not working well at the moment, it's because we haven't just done enough of it. You know, at some point in the future, that system will be proved to be the best, and all other things are demonstrably inferior, including any idea that might be associated with anarchism. And in these conversations I was having, I couldn't get them to grasp that actually what the system we're living under is actually very controlled and very narrow, and that you don't have to step too far outside of prescribed limits, which are often invisible until you test them for the system to come crashing down on your head. You know, you think you can more or less, you've got free speech, free association, and if you don't harm anyone else, you're free to do what you want. But you do not have to stray far from the path to feel the wrath of the system. And essentially, what we're looking at in a democracy is, it was one of the earliest shows that I did at Legalized Freedom. I read Hans Hermann Popper's book, Democracy, the God That Failed. He wasn't available to be interviewed, but I talked to a colleague called Andy Duncan about it. Is a 51% versus 49% essentially a mob rule system? But again, we're trained and taught not to see it that way. But again, as I say, the thrust of what I'm saying is you test those limits, and it doesn't take much to get pushback.
Well, I think that's very true. As far as what you were saying about the response to September 11th, I had think of American foreign policy, ironically, going back to the Vietnam War, as I just mentioned, and I developed a more serious critique of American foreign policy over time. I criticized the sponsored by the United States and Central America in the 1980s. I had been an opponent of the first Gulf War in 1991. And the aftermath of that, for the reason that I knew it would become what it became, it would be a series of never-ending wars in the Middle East. And after September 11th happened, my take on it was that while it was a horrible event, it was also important not to overreach as far as the response, and not just with domestic policy like security at airports and things like that, but also with foreign policy. For instance, after September 11th happened, the United States, as we know, went to war in Afghanistan, and the invasion of Afghanistan happened in October of that year. And in the month leading up to that time period, to the invasion of Afghanistan, I remember telling people, this is not going to have a positive ending. The United States is not going to win this war. And because I would say, well, if you look at history, the Soviet Union recently fought a 10-year war there with no success, and the British tried to successfully occupy that region, and it didn't happen. And going back to the antiquity, no one has really been able to successfully occupy the region that is considered to be Afghanistan in modern times. And of course, the response to that was typically things like, well, why are you on the side of the Taliban, or that kind of stuff. And I'm like, well, I'm just saying this war is going to be a losing war, and that's just, probably just going to be a sad fact of life. And the same was true in 2003 when the war in Iraq started, the second one. I remember saying at the time, well, what's likely to happen here is that if Saddam Hussein is removed from power, there's probably going to be an insurgent ground war by the Takfiris, the Al-Qaeda type groups, or alternately, if Iraq becomes a parliamentary state, then the Shia majority is going to take over, which means that Iraq will simply be a satellite of Iran. So you're going to be right back where you started. And of course, I had people at the time saying, well, why do you hate American troops and that kind of stuff? The kind of knee-jerk reflexive reaction. But I, for better or worse, I turned out to be correct, I think, in my analysis in all of those situations, because the things I just described actually happened. And as far as this idea that democracy is somehow sacrosanct, I also read Hans Hermann Hoppe's book, Democracy, the God That Failed, when it came out. I actually wrote a review of it that was circulated on a number of places, a very favorable review. I have a book of my own that's called Thinkers Against Modernity. And in that book, I explore the work of a lot of anti-modernist thinkers from a lot of different intellectual backgrounds, ranging from traditionalist Catholics like G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, and I also include the European New Right thinkers like Alain de Benoist. And I include Carl Schmitt and Nietzsche, as well as figures associated with the conservative revolution, like Ernst Jünger and Julius Evola and some of those kinds of thinkers. Because what I wanted to do with that book is take a look at what critics of modernity had to say about modernity as it was developing. And what did those who were essentially on the losing side of history have to say? And if some of their predictions were, some of what their criticisms of modernity were, we see that they had a point about certain things. But more than that, my experience was similar to yours, in that growing up in the West, we grow up with this idea, well, democracy is the best there is, and it's the apex of human civilizational achievement. And, you know, in the after the Cold War, we even had thinkers like Francis Fukuyama trying to claim it was the end of history and end of human political evolution and things like that. And for that, and I always wanted to argue against that. You know, I always wanted to argue that democratic states, you know, so-called liberal democracies, have all the same problems that states everywhere do. And I think that that's one of the key insights of anarchist political theory. You know, anarchist political theory essentially argues that the state, and by extension, you know, when I say the state, I don't mean just the political government. Like, I don't mean just the officials, you know, whether it's the president or the prime minister or the parliament or Congress or just the institutions of direct force, like the police or the military or whatever. When I say the state, I mean the entire power elite ruling class spectrum. You know, that would be the political government, that would be the national security institutions, but it would also mean the economic elites, you know, those who control the industrial and financial and technological systems, as well as those who control the cultural institutions, which in societies like we're familiar with, that would be the media, the educational system, organized religion to some degree still has influence. And then there's other, you know, nowadays, I suppose social media would be a big part of that. But all of that is part of the state. All of that is part of the ruling class. All of that is part of the power elite. But the anarchist view is that the ruling class or the state works basically the same way as organized crime. If you look at what organized crime does, what is its function? Well, they try to control territory, you know, markets to, you know, for extortion or racketeering or whatever. They try to eliminate competitors through violence. They try to monopolize resources. They try to exploit subjects in various ways. They try to expand their own domain of power and influence. You know, they do all of these things that are considered criminal in conventional terms. And then organized criminal groups often have their own self-legitimating beliefs and rituals and that kind of thing. For instance, in the American Mafia, when you join, you take a blood oath to whatever crime family you're joining. Or with gangs, you know, there's an initiation ritual and gang colors, you know, just like nations have flags and that kind of stuff. And the anarchist view is that the state, the ruling class, works in the same way as organized crime or criminal gangs, only on a much more sophisticated, massive level, and also exists for things like controlling territory, monopolizing resources, exploiting subjects, expanding their own realm of influence. And all states have a self-legitimating ideological superstructure. I think that's one thing the Marxists get right when they say that the state or the ruling class has an ideological superstructure of ideas that are used to legitimize the system, whatever system exists. And in our system, it's things like social contract theory and liberal democracy and, you know, the end of history, you know, all of these different kinds of ideas that have been put forward to legitimize the system that we know, you know, that is the ideological superstructure.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.